You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at our P.O. Box, 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for January 18th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Michelle Bachmann campaign staff breadline, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, everybody. And thank you for all your kind anniversary wishes. This is our third anniversary show.
Yay!
We are entering our fourth year as podcasters.
I know. It's creepy,
That's
isn't it?
Creepy.
Uh-huh.
And we're also tomorrow, the 19th, is our 17-month wedding anniversary.
Yay!
Yay! We were married August 19th of 2011. So.
And I'm rolling up on my eight-year blogiversary.
That's right. March 31st or so. Yeah.
Yep. Ah. End of March, beginning of April. 8 years of typing in front of a computer and tossing it into the abyss, into the uncaring vacuum of space.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And
it goes on.
And we're doing this in one take, pretty much.
We are. Schedules are tight this week, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're just
gonna do it live, people. Just about.
We're actually talking twice as fast as this, and we're and my sound
that
are just gonna slow it down to something, you know, like the end of 2001: Space Odyssey. That's what this will sound like if it all works out fine.
Issue one.
Yeah. Issue one.
We're moving along like John McLaughlin.
Yeah, let's. Yeah, that's a show I haven't seen in forever.
I know. I was so tired of it. Okay, the Supreme Court has upheld the restraining order against the Republican Party for interfering in elections.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Reince Priebus wants to make it so that Electoral College votes are assigned by whether you win a congressional district or not.
Yeah.
Because that'll guarantee them a win, pretty much. So, yeah. That'll work.
Yeah, I don't know if you all have had this experience. I know I have had a direct personal experience with someone who's doing an adversarial party doing a PowerPoint presentation, and we're going through their graphics and they're making this point and this point, and then you realize, wait a minute, this graph of all the possible representations of the data that they could have chosen, they chose the one that most screws me over and makes them look good.
Yep.
And that's when you raise your hand and go, wait a minute. Yeah, I realize I live in Chicago and my organization essentially encompasses whatever, theoretically at least 4 million people, and you live in Podunk. But when did we decide to change to geographical representation? Square miles. We're going to base our dues on square miles rather than and suddenly the conversation comes to a halt because what was supposed to be an objective analysis of the future of organizations has pretty clearly turned into, okay, we're kind of screwed, so we need to rig this so it'll come out the way we want to. Yep. And when you catch them doing that mid-sentence, it's kind of embarrassing. And now that...
Well, and they're doing it with Hurricane Sandy. They were doing it with Hurricane Sandy relief, too. Like, well, we're going to change the rules because it's New Jersey and New York. That's right.
Because we might lose.
Yeah.
Because we don't care. And you go down the list. Okay, the demonizing Acorn didn't work. Mm-hmm. And the new Black Panther Party didn't work. And creating new barriers to registration didn't work. And taking, you know, misallocating voting machines so that minority districts have vastly fewer machines didn't work. And cutting early voting down didn't work. What else can we do to cheat our way into power?
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, that is the way the conversation is never framed at the national level, because you're not allowed to point out the fact that one side of this equation are lying, cheating, corrupt douchebags. Mm-hmm. Not that my side wins any prizes for purity, but there is no symmetry in this. We don't have a spending problem in this country, a deficit problem in this country. We don't have a communication problem or a partisan problem. We have a Republican problem.
Well, and I think we have – I think what was said at Crooks and Liars this week that I put on our Facebook page and that will be linked in our links on our respective blogs is that we also have a corruption problem.
We do.
And one party is, at this moment, more corrupt than the other.
Yes.
And is owned by more corporations and lobbyists than the other. That doesn't mean, as you say, that we get any angel wings for the Democrats' behavior.
Plenty of dirty corporate money on our side of the ledger.
Absolutely. But. Absolutely. But this NRA thing has just gone way too far. And we'll get into that. But first of all, I want to talk about this lovely Republican retreat.
Yes.
I'm so sorry I'm not down in Virginia to be a fly on the wall at this thing. The Republican Party is working on rebranding itself.
Yes.
I guess like New Coke.
Yeah.
And they had a meeting with the Domino CEO to show them how the Domino CEO was going to talk to them.
Yeah. Well, step one, first of all, have you considered free crazy bread with every vote? Because that works really well.
And then you said, stuff more cheese up in that thing.
Yeah, stuff more cheese up the ass. Yeah, yeah, because you have the ingredients anyway. So just keep ramming in more of what you already have into the crap you already own.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, and I just get this really awful vision of 400,000 copies of Who Moved My Cheese being delivered to the Republican Party and trust falls and the rest of it. Because the one thing you're not allowed to do, again, the one thing you're absolutely not allowed to do is point out the fact that some people in this room are crazy.
Yeah. And that there's a real problem with our ideas and there's a real problem with how we govern rather than just the brand.
Yeah.
There's a real problem with Republican candidates who can't stop talking about rape and women's vaginas needing to be locked up. Mm-hmm. So,
this is in the DNA. You can't market way around that. If you go back to the good old days of 1994, when Newt Gingrich on the inside and Rush Limbaugh on the outside, and let's pause for a moment to remember, Rush Limbaugh has been on the air now for a quarter of a century.
Unbelievable.
And Rush Limbaugh's message hasn't changed substantially in that period of time. And the Republican Party threw a virtual parade for Rush Limbaugh in 1994. They called him the majority maker.
Yes.
One Republican leader after another credited him with their congressional victory. So when you hear conservatives say he's just an entertainer,
they had him on the House floor and handed him a plaque.
Yeah. And the plaque said majority maker.
Yep.
And you had a whole bunch of Republicans lining up to kiss his ring. This is back when Rush Limbaugh had a television career. Before he started saying
5 whole minutes,
But yeah, before he had an audience and started saying crazy racist shit that people in his audience would catch him on, and then he would sweat like the pig that knows it's dinner. So, but this is a long time ago. This is a long, long time ago in political years. And during that presentation, during the celebration, because Republican celebrations always have to be mean. They always have to be sour.
Yeah.
So this one silly woman, I can't remember her name, was standing up about, and X number of congressional women, congressional Republicans, strong congressional Republicans have won seats, and not a feminazi in the bunch.
Oh my gosh.
So let's remember that this language for describing women who don't like to have their vaginas controlled by old white men as a feminazi, as a castrating.
Well, and that's something that Lisa Murkowski has been trying to kind of explain. No, actually, you have to pass the Violence Against Women Act if you want to be considered.
Yeah.
If you want to be considered women supporting in any way.
Yeah.
And did you hear yet about the special little convo they've had this weekend? They're having this thing at Williamsburg, Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia, and so their convo on communicating with minorities and women is at the Burwell Plantation.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's at the big house or one of the little houses? I think it's probably up at the big house.
I think it's probably up at the big house. Don't you think? Juleps and some big fans waving. You know, maybe they could get some of those African Americans to wave a few big fans for them to keep them cool.
Yeah.
And then they could find out how to communicate with them.
You know, I just
bring me another mint julep.
at some point in every decision making process, this thing has to pass through like 9 hands.
Yeah.
And at some point, at no point in this discussion did somebody say, do you really want to hold the discussion about sensitivity to women and minorities at a fucking plantation? Do you really think that's a good idea? At point did anybody say
people that apparently broke the story as being unbelievably dense was National Review Online, who is not to me known as the guys in the front of the room pointing everyone in the right direction.
One more time, this is the tribe that rubs shit in their hair.
Yeah.
They cannot understand why people are offended by their stupid racist jokes and their stupid sexist jokes. And they cannot fathom. This goes back to Matt Taibbi's Tea and Crackers article about his direct reporting, spending time with Tea Party members in, I think it was Kentucky.
Yeah.
And talking to them and listening to them and getting the people on Social Security, the people that worked for the government, bitching about government spending, people whose entire life depended on government checks, bitching about other people getting government money and being not at all ashamed of that inconsistency. And he said, it wasn't their racism that blew me away. It was their jaw-dropping narcissism.
Yep.
That they had no idea that the shit that was coming out of their mouth was offensive. They had no clue that their very existence, their vocabulary, how they viewed the world was the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's no way to put crazy bread around that and sell it with some extra dipping sauce and pretend it's otherwise. 30 years ago, you could get away with it because you had Ronald Reagan, standing in front of these lunatics. You had people desperately pretending that the Southern strategy didn't exist. And this is all just a dream in your liberal imagination.
Yeah.
But now we're 30, 40 years into this experiment. And now the bones are sticking through the skin and the lesions are gaping open and oozing all over the place. And you can't pretend it's not happening anymore. And the most fascinating people in this equation are not the dumb fucks who booked a sensitivity course at a plantation who were Republicans. Mm-hmm. The most fascinating people of all to me, and we'll get to this in a little bit, are the people who still derive their living by pretending it's not happening.
Yep.
Those are the ones that are fascinating because those are the ones who are consciously, they get up in the morning, they look at themselves in the mirror, they go, okay, how am I going to lie to the American people today?
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
my job is to put lipstick on this fucking pig, to put perfume on this turd, and it's stinking now, it's rotting now, and yet I cannot acknowledge it or I lose my cushy job. So what combination of words and misdirection am I going to use to lie to the American people today?
Well, and the Beltway is so hooked up to the power as an aphrodisiac and the...
It stuns me, but it's completely understandable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It really is just high school.
The
day of the locust, these parasites swarming to whatever power center is available now and learning to mouth whatever words they need to mouth in ritual sense to pretend that they're still journalists, to pretend that they're still politicians, to pretend that they're still policy advocates as opposed to just servants of corporate power.
Yeah. And that article that I mentioned, I highly recommend it to everyone about how this is not an ideology. This is corruption.
Yeah.
And when you realize that the questions that are being asked, I mean, that's how this was framed. The questions being asked at the president's press conference, no one was asking about climate change. No one was asking about how people are dying from cigarettes. No one was asking about the health of the American people. There are all kinds of things that are not being asked about because the framers of the questions, as you've said, are the problem.
Either they refuse to think outside of their corrupt, moneyed positions, or they have, and this is even more tragic, they have so inculcated, they have so ingested their own bullshit that they can't think anymore any other way.
Well, and they're surrounded by people who are exactly like them, and it's very insular. And if that's the case, if you're attending any kind of institution, we all know institutions like this, churches, universities, civic groups, where they're just so insular that they don't see how weird they are.
Yeah, and they see that there's a problem.
Yeah.
And I've been through that management session in many different organizations where there is clearly some big steaming lump of something that that senior management is simply not going to fucking talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you broach the subject, meeting adjourned.
Yep.
And your manager will come to you and say, maybe you don't understand that we don't talk about that shit here because you haven't figured that out. But by the same token, they want the effect of a circulatory system.
Yep.
But they don't want to talk about the failing heart.
Yep.
Can't you just make it as if things were healthy and normal? No, because they're not. No. And you can't have effect without the cause. So, sorry, you're going to have to fix what's wrong. And what's wrong is you. That is the question that absolutely leaves my favorite targets, people like David Gregory and David Brooks, in absolute cold sweat terror.
But I think there's something bigger than that going on, which is with the 24-hour news cycle and the addiction to power that is going on, where John McCain gets people excited because he's a senator. And so his access to him means you're somebody. And if you live in that world, being able to call the senator's staff on your Rolodex is a big deal.
Yes.
And so
it's Luke Russert.
You've succeeded if you have access to power. And that's David Brooks's sweet spot for him is, oh, you know, I can call so-and-so and it's so wonderful. And I see this as sort of, I liken it to a church where everyone is in their 90s and it's day to day. Yeah, you're having 30 or 40 funerals a year in your church, but you can't talk about that as the church is dying because everyone will be offended.
Right.
You know, you're killing grandma or you're saying this is a death panel or you're saying we need and younger blood, screw that. We're all, you know, happy here with what we've got.
Yeah.
So I feel like this beltway mentality of, you know, change it. Why? You know, we've got exactly what we need. Mm-hmm. And even though each day our democracy is being chipped away at and you see it in these little episodic funerals for democracy. Well, but we're not going to change that because my place, if you question my place, then you're saying there's something wrong with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not going to happen.
And that's a lovely metaphor because when you're inside that bubble, everything's a one off.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Letting an American city drown, lying us into a war, the persistent pathological racism, all those things don't count.
Right.
Or they're all explained away.
She had cancer. She had heart problems. She had this. She had that. No, you guys are all in your 90s. No, you guys are all addicted to money and power. And corporations are giving you that. So you're letting them write the legislation so that you can continue to have access. And everybody's just letting that happen because that's what makes me who I am. Yeah, it's exactly the same thing.
And everything rolls along fine. This is what I observed in Chicago. Everything rolls along fine until the money runs out.
Yep. Yeah. So
resources start drying up. Yep. And that's when you see who's in and who's not, and who's got connections and who doesn't. And in this case, you really do see that the people who have been fronting the cash for the Republican Revolution for 40 years are now shortening the leash so tight that they can't breathe anymore.
You will
come out for absolute unlimited access to firepower for everyone, or we will kill you. You will come out for absolute deregulation of everything all the time. You will regulate the fuck out of women's vaginas, or we'll cut you off.
Yeah.
And the hidden hand of the corporate overlords, of the crackpot right-wing billionaires who run the show, is no longer hidden. It's out in plain view.
Yeah.
And that's where things start to flake out. I made a note to myself in our little pregame notes about how not to plan a wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about that.
It was a little post I tossed off, but it was, you know, if like me, you were silly enough to go to an alternate hippie run high school, at least for a couple of years. I went to one such place and everything had to be done by consensus. Every single fucking thing had to be done by consensus. And you would have town meetings, quote unquote, that would go on for days to plan a picnic. It was an education in human nature and sort of how teenagers can behave. But let's suppose you're trying to plan a wedding. And let's suppose you went to one of these high schools and you want everyone in your family, every friend, every stakeholder, everyone who's interested in your wedding to have a say. So we'll have a round table.
There are whole reality shows built around that premise, believe me.
That's my fear. And everyone gets around the table and you have people who want a traditional Wiccan ceremony and people who want high church, low church, no church. Let's go to a judge for the 5-minute ceremony or whatever it is. In our backyard, 1,000 people, 5 people, etc. And you just let them thrash it out and thrash it out and thrash it out. And there's no budget really. There's no time limit. It's just, I'm going to get married. My spouse and I are going to get married. Let's figure out sort of all the options that are available. But that's a suicidally dumb way to run wedding planning. Mm-hmm. But the thing that escalates it into truly ludicrous proportions that makes it impossible is that if you invite someone to the table who firmly believes you should not get married.
Yep.
And who says very clearly, oh, no, I think your marriage will destroy freedom in America. Mm-hmm. Therefore, no matter what you do, I'm going to be opposed to it. Yep. No matter what committee I serve on, I'm going to find a way to turn that committee into a tool to destroy your wedding planning because mm-hmm. I think this wedding is a bad idea.
Yep.
That's the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly happy to talk about Social Security, fixing Social Security with anybody other than people who think Social Security should be destroyed. And I made it painfully clear that that is all they're interested in for the last 70 years.
Right.
Medicare, ditto. Medicaid, ditto. Any other social program, education system. I'm happy to sit around a big old table with people of goodwill who are agnostic or high church or low church. But you can't invite people and give them a veto. Giving them control over your process, who tell you up front, I'm here to destroy the process.
Yep.
Where's my seat? Yep. Fuck you. You don't have a seat. Go away.
Yep.
And that's where we stand now. I don't even have a problem with people who have a very specific agenda item. They have a very specific lobby driven, because lobbyists are not inherently evil. Every group that has an interest has a lobbyist.
Yeah.
Except for poor people.
Yep.
And so I don't even mind. I've been buttonholed by former employees or employers, mm-hmm. people with a great deal of power who show up at a committee I happen to be sitting on and are there on someone else's dime to do one thing. And that's work people like me and get their one thing on the table and then get that passed or not and then go home and, bake cookies.
Yep.
I don't have an objection. That's fine. That is the democratic process. But you cannot have someone at the table who announces proudly that they're there to chop the table into pieces and to set it on fire.
And this debt ceiling bill is exactly what is doing that. Yeah. The House GOP is now worried about whether or not they'll keep the House because people are paying attention to this debt ceiling thing. And the philosophy of let's burn it all to the ground and celebrate on the ashes is not going over well with a lot of people.
No, but it's going over well with enough people in the Republican House that the people who are supposed to know better dare not either don't know any better or dare not say so, because the minute they do, the monster they built, the deadfall they dug and filled with pointy sticks, they'll pitch right back into it and die of their own wounds. And there's a certain dark hilarity to the fact that clearly these people never saw The Sorcerer's Apprentice and never read Gollum and never read Frankenstein and never listened to any cautionary tale about you really shouldn't build monsters that you can't control and then turn them loose. Because that's really, Abby something.
Abby Normal. Really?
What? Put Jerry Falwell's brain in the Republican Party? Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time. And we won some elections and... Well, yeah, but now it's running amok through the countryside and killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't pretend you didn't create it, because now it's coming after you. And the hilarious, tragic part is, again, there were a lot of people standing on the sidelines who were smart enough and observant enough to say, you will fucking live to regret this. Pardon, I'm using that F word a lot today.
That's all right. But you know what?
You will live to regret this.
We know who those people are. They're called liberals.
Yeah. And now the day has come. And that brings us around probably to.
Well, I wanted you to talk about the most dangerous graphs in America in relation to that. Because
The most
perfectly germane to that. Yeah.
Are currently available on driftclass.blogspot.com. But there's a, I'm going to blow the name and it's short, but it's View Vote or Vote View. It's an organization that has tracked the voting outcomes in terms of ideology over the last, 150 years or whatever, congressional voting. And some of you might remember that a year ago, I did a little post on 1972 that the central argument for centrism, for the big lie of centrism, for the big lie of both sides do it is, well, at one point in time, there were two parties. There was a center left and a center right. And since whatever, pick a point in time, the left has rocketed off to the extreme, extreme, extreme left. And the right has skyrocketed off to the right, right, right. And only the sensible, sane, serious people are still in the middle trying to get these two extreme, partisan, opposite, polar, ridiculously offensive and intractable groups to work together. And yet, when you look at the actual record, when you look at party platform of the Democratic Party in 1972 and compare it to 2012, There's no change. Party hasn't moved right at all. It hasn't moved left at all. It's moved right in a lot of ways. It's drifted, you know, disturbingly right from my liberal point of view, but it certainly hasn't gone left. If it had gone left from 1972, we would be in a full-on socialist system.
Nationalize the banks.
Nationalize everything. Yeah. We don't have that. Pot would be legal and plentifully available. There would be no God on the money. There, you know, all of those things would now be true, except none of those are true. None of those are even up for discussion. But the right has gone crazy-ass right. The right really has gone from Nixon's time, from the 60s and 70s to now. The right has blazed new trails into crazy town. And I put up a graphic. It wasn't a true chart, but it was my impression of here's the line of where the left has actually gone. Here's the line of where the right has actually gone. And here's the right where the imaginary left that the Beltway press constantly obsesses over insists that the left really is over here. Because if you're in the center, it only makes sense to be a centrist if you believe that both sides really are equally extreme. And so it's imperative that you create a completely fictional liberalism that doesn't exist at all, that's a fairy tale, that's a David Brooks, David Gregory fairy tale, to counterbalance the true psychotic right. That way you can continue to pretend that the center is the place you want to be. Well, this vote organization did actual – they used science. You know, fancy that. They used science and counted votes and said, no, since about the mid-70s – way to go, Driftglass. Since about the mid-70s, the Democratic Party has remained pretty static. Their votes have remained remarkably consistent. It's just a flat line, pretty much a flat line. The right, however, has just zoomed off into Crazyville, has just gone. And the reason this is the most dangerous graph in America is the central lie of the Beltway media is and always has been both sides do it.
You know, we want to give a major hat tip to Lawrence O'Donnell this week, who almost went full Driftglass, which
he really did. He bless his heart.
He really did. Well, I just think it's funny that full Driftglass is a thing now.
Yeah.
Going full Driftglass needs to wind up in the Urban Dictionary from somebody.
Yeah.
And what it means is saying what the truth is about both sides do it and centrism.
And both sides don't.
And he did just say, look, this is not a matter of both sides. This is a matter of one side being wrong. Mm-hmm. And we were both very excited to see that, the revival of the both sides sort of don't.
Like Monty Python and what am I thinking of? Wainscoting, you know?
Yeah.
They mentioned this on the telly. They mentioned this again. So whenever anyone breaks through, Mr. Ornstein and Mr. Mann show up on a show, or Lawrence O'Donnell says it, or Barack Obama. President Obama says something like this to David Gregory's face that freaks him so badly out that he has to come back and rebut it once the president's safely out of the building.
That's known as going full Driftglass, going full Driftglass.
And it is fun to watch and fun to listen to. But I'm not highly focused on this because I'm an obsessive person or because it amuses me, although both of those things are actually true. But I am highly focused on it because I'm absolutely convinced that the big lie of centrism, the big lie both sides do it, is the pillar that holds up the entire establishment. And if that lie is ever challenged, because it's the lie that makes every other lie possible. Scratch a Republican, scratch a conservative, watch a conservative. Every single time one of their lies blows up in their face, every single time you debunk them, the immediate next words out of their mouth are, yeah, but what about Huffington Post? What about Al Gore? Whether it has anything to do with the topic or not, they find some imaginary group of liberals far away and try to divert the conversation to, well, yeah, but liberals are equally wrong about everything. So conservative, that is the absolute fallback, last ditch, spider hole position of every conservative. And it's the bread and butter of every centrist douchebag from David Gregory to David Brooks in the media. And once that lie gets exposed, once that balloon pops, there's no place for them to hide.
Except Yale University.
Yeah, well.
Thank you to everyone who emailed us with the link to David Brooks's syllabus.
Yeah.
his humility course.
His course on humility.
I read the entire 4-page syllabus and printed it out, actually, because I wanted to have a paper copy of this. I found it fascinating that he's going to do kind of a survey history and read Dorothy a Day and read some Aeschylus, I think. And, you know, he's going to sort of do this kind of survey. But he starts off, the first three lectures of the first 3 weeks are about the decay of civility and humility since 1950.
Yeah.
And how it's the hippies' fault. I mean, it really comes across very clear that this Yale course, which is only going to have 20 students, by the way.
It is proven beyond any doubt, given Mr. Brooks's column in the New York Times today, his conversation with Gail Collins.
Oh, this is on Thursday's paper?
A Wednesday paper,
okay.
When she asked him, do you really think that there is, as Colin Powell said, a dark vein of intolerance running through the right, running through the Republican Party? He said, no, that's not true at all. In fact, Democrats are much more intolerant than Republicans. I go to lots of secret meetings with Democrats and Republicans, and Democrats are always more intolerant than Republicans. And this is not the first time he's told this lie. He's told a lie about Reagan and how Reagan never ran a racist campaign. Reagan never did any such thing. And he has been raked over the coals and beaten up in the press repeatedly for this particular kind of lie. Mm-hmm. But if you read him sort of on a semi-regular basis like I do, and you see the kind of things he writes about obsessively, he is really and truly involved in a massive project to completely rewrite the last history of the last 50 years of conservatism and turn it into a fairy tale about noble Whigs navigating through treacherous hippie country, being guided by the noble and humble David Brooks.
And that's what this course is about.
He's, you know, this goes back to what he's written about Penn State being basically the dirty hippies and the collapse of morals in the 60s was responsible for Penn State. He writes about this crap a lot. And it all comes down to he has a very, very radical worldview that is completely unsupported by the facts. And he lies about it all the time. He lies about his own past. He lies about what other people say. He lies about economics. He lies about history. But his life only makes sense if history is the way he keeps persistently telling people that it is. And he has lots of people around who keep saying, good job, David.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Shields is never going to call David Brooks a liar on the air. E.J. Dionne's never going to call him out. David Gregory is never going to stop inviting him on the show and letting him espouse whatever the fuck he wants to talk about. But he is absolutely engaged in a massive project to completely wipe out the last 50 years of conservative history and replace it with a David Brooks fairy tale. And it's working. He is succeeding at this. I'm not kidding. He is, because 10, 20, 30 years from now, when we have a debate about what the fuck went wrong at the tail end of the 20th and the early 21st century, if David Brooks's version of history is the accepted version, then it will be, conservatism was a noble effort that failed due to poor management, but it failed due to the rotting morals of the society beneath it that were caused by the dirty hippies. And that will be the history of this country if David Brooks is permitted to continue lying in public like this. And one big leg of that is now he has a class at Yale. But we're getting ever closer to the day, which is going to be a very frightening day, but I think a very ultimately healthy occurrence, where we can actually start debating the real ugly truths that underlie our political and social and media system. We can actually start talking about what happens when one of your two major political parties goes insane. What do you do when one of the two pillars of your political society goes nuts and won't behave like Democrats in a democracy, won't accept the rules of the game and decide, fuck it, we're just going to crash the system, and if we have to destroy everything to get our way, then we're going to do it.
Well, speaking of people that like to do that sort of thing, of crash the system in order to get their way, we have to talk again about the NRA.
Yes, we do.
And particularly, I wanted to talk for just a moment about this Obama daughter's ad, web ad, because it turns out not only is it just vicious and nasty and a clear attempt to change the subject away from the results of gun violence to anything else, just anything else, even their own evil. It's better to talk about our own evil than to talk about gun violence, because then we're on firmer ground.
May I mention that Rachel Maddow did 10 minutes on this last night, mm-hmm. saying this is just trolling.
Yeah.
That's all this. This was invented to make you angry.
Yep.
So that you'll argue something other than what they don't want to argue about.
Which is guns killing children.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't want to talk about that. And not only is it trolling, but it's lying as well. You know, it turns out Sidwell Friends doesn't have armed guards at their school. Yeah. So it's a lie, but it is absolutely just, let's do something nasty and awful and attention grabbing and quick, so that we don't talk about children dying from guns, because we can't win on that topic. So let's change it to anything else. And I also wanted to say, just if you watch that ad in the framework of what I've been saying for weeks now, that perhaps we should nationalize DC gun laws rather than armed guards at schools, which apparently does not exist even at the school where the Obama's children go. You know, the kind of protection that Congress and the Supreme Court and the White House have within the framework of DC gun laws is unparalleled.
Yeah.
And no one talks about, let's weaken DC gun laws so that people can do concealed carry in the Supreme Court building, because that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about that.
Oh.
You know, nobody wants concealed carried hippies walking around Scalia, right? I mean,
or Black Panthers.
Or Black Panther. Yeah, the new Black Panther Party might just try to walk around. You know, there's, in D.C., there's a lot of disenfranchised African-American voters.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and everyone here probably recalls that some of the earliest state-level gun control in California was proposed and enacted because Black people started showing up in numbers with guns.
Legislative sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They started showing up saying, no, this is the Constitution and we're allowed to do this. And nothing so terrifies the heart of a white racist or a white racist, someone who wants to profit from that racism like Ronald Reagan did for his entire career, than the sight of a well-regulated militia full of Black people with guns showing up at a public event going, no, this is, you know,
this is we're Second Amendment.
And they changed those laws so fast, make your head spin.
Well, and I'd love to see, and we're going to talk about Tom Hartman's article too, but I'd love to, if I had $1 million to flush down the toilet, I'd love to just buy NRA membership for like 2 million Black people.
Yeah.
You know, just see what happens. Go to the next convention. Every armed Black people all everywhere, you know, and see how the NRA reacted to that.
Yeah.
But Tom Hartman had an article about the Constitution and the Second Amendment specifically, saying that this well-regulated militia that they're talking about is the Virginia militia, which was set up to recover runaway and escaped slaves. And the whole argument about states' rights being perfectly all right when you have to deal with slavery, pro-slavery positions.
Yeah.
But Connecticut or Massachusetts' right to say, no, once an African American crosses into our state, we recognize them as free. That state's rights goes right out the window.
Yeah. The state's rights for me, but not for thee.
Not for anyone else. Yeah. Right.
So
only when it benefits me, which goes right along with, you know, Sandy relief. It's been going on that long.
Well, and mention the fact that not only was this was not an abstract argument. This was the South wanted the federal government to ensure the return of their property.
Absolutely. And if regardless of what Connecticut said or what Massachusetts or New Hampshire had to say about it, screw them.
And militias were formed to retrieve
retrieve slaves. And the South insisted that they be paid for out of the federal kitty. So, you know, national taxpayers had to across the country were to pay to return slaves to the South.
And
it goes on. It's the same as it ever was.
Well,
you know, it's not slavery anymore. Now it's hurricane relief.
And if you're Black, you couldn't have a gun, not because of the Second Amendment, but because you weren't a citizen.
You weren't a person.
You weren't a person.
Yeah.
So you didn't get to have a gun.
And you mentioned California. I want you to mention this other news item from California as well. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. That California has balanced its budget.
Can
and
you
is now operating.
That?
Pardon me.
Can you believe that?
And is now operating apparently, at least on paper, a surplus. I haven't read the California budget. I don't know if it's full of trickery and strange rounding errors and accounting tricks. But
well, they did raise taxes in their
They cut services and they raised taxes. But they finally got enough Democrats apparently.
They have a Democratic supermajority in the
to pass.
To
what
pass
they wanted to.
They can pass anything, right?
And you know, you can argue over what they should have done and what should have been cut and whether, you know, whether or not Jerry Brown should have taken the path he took. But the argument always was that see what happens when liberals run things.
Yeah, spendocrats.
California is ungovernable because of the crazy unions and the fact that Democrats don't want to pay their bills, which is a fabulous argument from the party that, again, 12 years ago voted against budget surpluses on a national level. George W.
Away.
Bush. Let me repeat. George W. Bush ran against budget surpluses. Mm-hmm. It was in his acceptance speech 7 times at the Republican convention. It was in his advertising. He said, we have to get rid of these terrible, pesky, troublesome budget surpluses. And people who were in his party, the goon squad of the Republican Party, the intellectual vanguard of conservatism, said, and I'm talking again about you, David Brooks, wrote articles saying, yeah, get rid of that damn surplus because the budget is so secure. The economy is now so bulletproof and things are just going to get so much better and better no matter what George W. Bush does to it that there's no point in having that. We can have tax cuts. Yeah, sure. We can have that. No problem at all. We're never going to have deficits again. Says the man and who wrote article after article mocking Democrats for suggesting that Bush policies would cause deficits and mocking people who thought it was a good idea to have, you know, a balanced budget or budget surpluses because that's never going to happen again. Now, it's perfectly fine to be wrong about that. But you don't then 10 years later get to whine about how irresponsible and reckless Democrats are and how they don't recognize how important it is to get rid of those darn deficits. And how isn't it a shame that we've had this generation of deficit and debt politics where serious people are not listened to when it comes to treating this deficit as a real problem? Fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to say it, but apparently you do. Apparently you get to have a class at Yale and you get to have anything you want. You get to have newspapers and radio and appear on television to your heart's content if you lie in that particular way. But again, our job as liberals, if nothing else, is to document the past, is to keep a little candle burning in the national recollection that what you are being told on television, especially by centrists and conservatives, are lies. And the thing is, all of the stuff that you need to prove them to be lies are sitting there preserved in digital amber.
Yes.
They're all out there. All they require for anyone to see this to be true, to expose Tom Friedman or David Brooks or any of these guys as liars, is a mouse and a computer and access to the internet. That's all you need to do. And the fact that we refuse as a media to do those things is for me the story. The story, for instance, of the Republican Party is not that they're crazy. The Republican Party's cool, interesting aspect is that the tenacity with which the same people cling to one incredibly fucked up, awful idea after another, after another, after another, and never learn anything. And the fact
Driftglass, I think the tide is turning on that kind of remembering because there's a new video out from the Democratic Party that is simply a video of Peter King and New Jersey Governor Christie bitching about the Republican House members and saying, you know, enjoy your kumbaya moment retreat in Williamsburg. And that was clearly put together by a new generation of ad maker who is post YouTube in sensibility. So
I hope so.
Yeah. I think that the Obama boots on the ground have proven that they know how to put these kind of things together with their Romney ad of him singing America the Beautiful, which was really the most effective ad of the whole campaign.
It was,
you know, and these post YouTube ad people really do have that sensibility that works not only on the web, but it really gets people's attention. So let's hope they're able to continue to succeed at that.
I hope so, because one of the things that I know you and I both just tore our hair out over when John Kerry was running for office, mm-hmm. is inability to tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
That the pros, the political PROSE, mm-hmm. that are used by people when they run for office is so, especially on the left, is so freighted with insider baseball acronyms, newspeak, and charts and graphs, and just that's incomprehensible jargon to anyone who isn't already hip to what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And they just don't know how to get out of their own way. They don't know how to clear all that junk away and talk simply and clearly about who the bad guys are, who the good guys are. And I did want to have one brief aside, speaking of good guys and bad guys. Michael Gerson wrote this remarkable article in the Washington Post. Michael Gerson, for those of you who don't know, was George Bush's speechwriter. And like all former George Bush speechwriters, Michael Gerson went straight into a job, a high-paying media job at the Washington Post and appearing on Face the Nation or Meet the Press whenever he wants to. So there is no downside to being a part of Team Evil. Team Evil pays very well and has great job security. But he wrote this whiny-ass article about how Barack Obama is about to use his inaugural address to essentially call the Republicans out for being obstructionist assholes, and how unfair that is, and how violative of the whole spirit of inaugurations it is for that kind of rhetoric, kind of divisive rhetoric, to ever be used at, you know, once someone's elected. That inauguration time, a new administration, is a time of healing between the parties. It's a time of reaching out between the people and trying to get the people who fought so much and blah 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 to, you know, to play nice with each other. And isn't it a shame that Barack Obama is going to use his inaugural address for petty partisan purposes and mean-spiritedness? And I just read this and just laughed that a member of the Bush administration, who ran for office in 2004. Calling John Kerry a traitor and a coward and telling people that your children will die in a horrible terrorist attack if you vote for the wrong party, and who then after the election spent most of their time spiking the ball, we won, you lost, fuck you, would dare to open his fucking pie hole about magnanimity. And again, 4 years later, when Barack Obama won, let's not forget that the entire leadership cast of the Republican Party spent inauguration evening plotting how they were going to destroy the Obama presidency. How can we best not cooperate ever?
Hey, Driklas, we got a wonderful letter in the mail this week. It's just fantastic, and it's the nicest 3-year anniversary gift that we could get. Although, if you've never sent us any money and you're listening to old episodes, how about sending us $3 this week? $1 for each year for our 3-year anniversary. If you can afford it, if you went out to lunch this week, you can afford to send us $3. How about that?
I don't know that that's a sound economic model, Blue Gal, but.
Anyway, we got this wonderful letter, and it is from Letitia. And Letitia writes, "Dear Driftglass and Blue Gal, thank you for your podcasts, which make me feel less alone and less weak. Recently, I wrote a letter to the editor of my university magazine in response to a puff piece about a hotshot business school professor who was talking about restoring the moral foundation of capitalism."
Yes, we need to do that pretty soon.
maybe sometime. My main point was that there is no such thing any more than there is a moral foundation to evolution. And that there is no way you can restore something that doesn't exist. I was happy to see that the only change the editors made to my letter was to remove the word stupid.
Wow. You're good.
Yeah, in describing this professor's idea. Well, congratulations on getting your letter published.
Yeah.
That is really awesome. Anyway, I tell you this because I wouldn't have done it without you.
Aw.
I'm sure the business school professor, if he was even aware of my letter, cried into his pillow every night while he collects his enormous salary and negotiates his enormous book contracts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know my letter didn't change anything. Oh, well, maybe it did.
Yeah, you know.
Maybe it changed some tiny little unseen thing. Even if your podcasts haven't changed public policy, they have changed me.
Oh.
It is really important that liberals know that we're out there, that we are willing and able to speak up and fight even on one little point.
Yep.
And even one little point is worth addressing.
It is.
BPLP equals Before Professional Left Podcast. I would have read the article, gotten mad, and said, what's the use, and moved on. But it was very gratifying to write that letter. And I got many positive reactions from people I know, not just friends. I like to think I made them feel less alone and less weak.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish the check could be more. But I have my own tiny violin playing for my family, and I know you understand. And
absolutely, yeah.
Totally. And thank you for your contribution. Sincerely, Letitia. And do you mind if I read the PS? Because it's
not at all. Please,
maybe,
please.
Maybe we'll talk about it next week. We don't have a lot of time left today. But PS, may I bring up one unrelated thing? After hearing you talk about Archie Bunker types who are perfectly good and moral and fine as long as their worlds continue smoothly functioning as they are supposed to. I didn't see the movie Fatal Attraction when it came out in the 80s, but I remember it caused quite a stir. People talked about how it promoted the idea that strong, independent urban women are insane and dangerous and a threat to the traditional family, especially to the good wife. Feminists were pretty mad about it, and I imagine I would have been too if I'd seen it at that time. But when I watched the movie recently, I was fascinated at how it took on a completely different meaning in 2012. You watch the supposedly good couple become selfish, angry, crafty murderers when their world is upset by a disturbed, pathetic woman.
Uh-huh.
They are good as long as their life moves along proper rails. Oh, that's really good.
Yep. Yep.
But once the crazy woman derails it, the couple's morality vaporizes. Their survival mode is to dehumanize the crazy woman and to become anything and do anything that is expedient to defeating her. The fatal attraction was fatal only to her and a pet rabbit. Seen in that light, it is a very sad and compelling movie for an age in which large populations throw out principles and compassion when they become frightened. Isn't
yeah.
that wonderful? Well, I'm not surprised that they published your letter.
No.
And we just published your letter. So thank you, Letitia, very much. For writing to us. And boy, that just makes it all worthwhile, doesn't
Indeed.
It, Trip Glass, that she went and spoke the truth to power?
Well, and the second half of that letter, I don't want to comment on how disturbingly close to the Joker's observations of human nature that
no,
comes.
Like, absolutely, though. Yeah.
You know, people are as good as you let them be.
Yep.
But the minute you drop the veil of civilization, they turn on each other. And that's one point. I happen to not believe that.
Mm-hmm.
It's you don't ever want to let that happen, but I happen to not believe that. Can I tell you very, very briefly what the first part of Letitia's letter reminded me of a little bit?
Yeah.
Once upon a time, there was a man named Harlan Ellison.
Everybody take a drink.
Everybody take a drink. And once upon a time, there was a guy named Ronald D. Moore, who wrote for Star Trek. And was a very good writer on Star Trek. And he's the guy who went on to, as Harlan Ellison put it, take the worst television series in history and turn it into the best television series in history. That would be Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. Very good writer, very principled guy. Apparently wrote the opening, the pilot for Battlestar Galactica with a statement of principles on the front page of the script, which no actor had ever seen before. You know, this is what we're going to change science fiction. Here's how we're going to do it.
Mm.
But between those times, Ronald Moore was at one time a beginning writer, just starting out. And he had the opportunity to write a television series. It wasn't Star Trek. It was something else. I think it was The Dragon Riders of Pern or something like that. But there were people depending on this series going forward. And there were grips and cameramen and all sorts of other folks depending on this story moving forward. And he was the guy. And the network executives had come down, I think it was on the WB, had come back to him and said, okay, here's how you're going to change this classic science fiction story so it will suck. Essentially, we would like you to really ruin the artistic integrity of the piece because we're basically accountants and assholes and we don't understand these things. So you're going to have to compromise in a way
from...
You
want the manimal element
We do. Can you throw more sex into it? And he was really confused and really... Because it is a legitimate thing to worry that your pursuit of your artistic integrity, pursuit of your purity... This happens in politics all the time. That your pursuit of purity... is going to be so severe that you're actually going to get lots of people you like fired.
Yeah.
And they're going to go hungry and your reputation will be wrecked and on and on and on. None of that obviously happened. You know, we know how the story sort of ends because Ronald Moore wrote Battlestar Galactica. But he was really having a, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And that evening, apparently, he was sitting on a panel with Mike Straczynski, who wrote Babylon 5. And Harlan Ellison and himself, and they were talking about writing for television and writing science fiction, and they were going around the room and asking questions, and it was the advice for writers. And Ronald Moore had said something noncommittal, and then it goes to Harlan Ellison, who he admires very much, and Ellison says, "Whatever you do, don't be a whore. Don't sell out. Don't do it. Don't do it. It has to count. What you do has to count. It has to have integrity, or it's worthless. It's don't sell out. Don't do it." And it just happened to be the perfect message at the perfect moment. He was ready to hear that from that person in that moment. So, Leticia, you never, ever know when that rock you throw into the pond, as Mr. Ellison says, kills the fish. You know, you never know. And I always advise people, generally speaking, being liberals, you have to be out in the world and you have to be ready to encounter people. Have your elevator speech ready.
Yeah.
Have your 2-minute, here's why I'm a liberal, here's why conservatism sucks, here's why having this debate is senseless because the predicating assumption you're talking about is bullshit, ready in a way that doesn't make you sound hostile or crazy or jumping down someone's throats, but be ready to talk about your passions and be ready to defend them because you never know when you're going to be in that perfect venue and the person who really needs to hear what you have to say at that moment is primed and ready. And be ready for that moment. So congratulations, Leticia. I'm very proud of you.
Yeah, congratulations. We are proud of you, and we are honored that you are inspired by this podcast to do those kind of things. It's just fantastic. It just made our whole week. Speaking of whores, Driftglass.
Yes, don't we always?
I want to mention something that came up a couple of weeks ago on Rachel Maddow about Dick Morris.
Yes.
Speaking of whores, yes. Dick Morris. And I just wanted to point out to people listening to our podcast, you know, Dick Morris has been exposed, as he often is, as somebody who is not very ethical when it comes to fundraising. And he fundraises with his own list, and then he goes off and charges other companies to fundraise and pretends that they're his organization when they're not, and then goes to court and says they're not, and he's just very dishonest. And I just wanted to let our listeners know that we don't list rent to anyone ever, and we never will.
And explain what list rent is.
Well, list rent is when you take, for instance, if you give us $3 this week, we take your name and address and put it in a database and then make it available to somebody else. And we never do that, and we never will. I promise you, we will never do that.
And you and I have been fundraising as bloggers for a number of years. I do keep a list of people who I'm terrible at keeping up with people, but I do keep a list of everyone who, has sent a dollar my way because I want to say thank you.
Yeah.
Because
I hold on to the emails. Absolutely. For myself. So
but
that
never,
I can...
ever, ever do we let that information out of our site. Never.
No. And we won't. And I know that, you know, when I subscribed to In These Times, all of a sudden I started to get mail from ACLU and Mother Jones and a lot of other places. And for some places, especially liberal institutions, that's how they pay the rent, is sharing mailing lists.
My stepfather used to subscribe to magazines under different names.
And different middle initials. Yeah.
Like barium samples, you know, it flow through the body politic. And, oh, look. Here's a cluster of new ads, new requests, new clamoring for your money from under this name. Well, now I know which magazine sells me out.
Yep.
Anyway, it's when you have a lot of time.
And sometimes, you know, if it's filtered well, people don't mind that. And I noticed one time this month, I got letters from three different needlework knitting organizations, and you held them out and you went, "What the hell?" Yeah. Like, give those to me.
Yeah. Well, I don't care.
You know, that doesn't mean I respond to everyone, but I'm a knitter. And so it doesn't bother me that other yarn companies are sending me stuff.
Or no.
That information that I'm a knitter is out there.
But by
expect it to be.
By the same token, I have given a couple of dollars to political campaigns, but I try to do it cash. I try to go to events, contributions.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be on your database.
Yeah.
I've gone to Netroots Nation.
Yeah, yeah.
Years ago, you know, I exchanged three or four emails, and suddenly, Dear Drift.
Dear Drift, that's from Facebook.
from Mr. Adam Green Urgent, as we call him.
Adam Green Urgent is
every email from Adam Green is urgent. And suddenly, I'm getting for one or two responses to one or two legitimate causes that I wanted to sign a petition or I wanted to know more about. I can't swing a digital dead cat.
Yeah.
Without hitting nine emails from the same person who is all about we and us, and we've made it so far, but we still need more help. And I've trained my eye just to, this is sad, but I look for the dollar sign.
Yeah.
And it's always in the second to last paragraph.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I understand the need for it. I understand.
And sometimes it's really important to give to those organizations. No problem with that. It's a question of, I especially like it if it's about SOPA or PIPA. All of a sudden you're realizing they got your email from another list, you know.
Yes,
but
they
want to talk about internet privacy.
and one of these days we'll do a show on sort of what we understand and know about the behind how the machinery works.
Oh yeah, behind, you could go on for 3 hours about internet privacy and spam and all kinds. Yeah.
Well, and how blogs pay their bills.
Yeah. Yeah.
How Scientology hijacked the Atlantic magazine, because that's how you pay your bills.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so forth. But that's a different show for a different day.
It's a different show for a different day. And thank you so much to all of you who help us pay our bills. I mean, full disclosure, we use the checks and PayPal donations that you send to pay our electric bill, pay part of our cable bill, and get ice cream for the kids. That's what we do with your money. So, full disclosure, if you're not able to afford to send us money, this podcast is our gift to you.
Absolutely.
And that's how we really do feel that way.
But it goes right back in the economy. Count on it.
Immediately. It goes back in.
We're not sitting on this waiting for the bond market to shift.
Of podcast donations. No way. It goes out every month. Every week we post to our website and Facebook page an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Pina, which is short for Agrippina Minor. Wonderful name.
Yeah.
She's a gray kitty sitting on a laptop keyboard, which they're not supposed to do that, but she does.
But it's warm and people.
It's warm.
It smells like people.
And it gets you lots of attention immediately.
Yes. Look at me.
Speaking of that's another story for another day. The day your cat took off several keys off your keyboard at one time.
I learned all about the microscopic plastic interlacing pieces
underneath the keys
go into making a key go up and down on this particular model of keyboard.
Oh,
it was quite an adventure. But again, different story, different day.
Different story, different day. But you can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. And be aware that if you write us at any address, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Union, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Oh, my God. The Internet Kitties are on the cover of Newsweek.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
About Martin Luther King, he was a peacemaker. He did not believe in fighting. Martin Luther King had 4 children. He had a dream. That means he had a vision that when his 4 children grew up, a white person wouldn't say that, I can't play with you because you're black. They would say, oh, come on, play with me. So that's what vision he had. And if you had to go to the bathroom and it said white only, brown people can't go to that bathroom. Martin Luther King made a big change. If you had a friend that was black and you liked them as a friend, then back in the old days when Martin Luther King was still alive, you couldn't play with that friend because some people were this word, but I hate to say this word, some people were stupid. Because they thought that you couldn't play with other people. It's not really on the outside, it's really in the inside of the person. So it's not in the outside, it's in the inside. That's what I wanted to talk about today. I hope you like that.